Because when you lift black women, you lift everybody else. Period. Okay. Like, that's just, like, right? And that's it. When you lift black women, you lift everybody, because so much of the work of humanity falls on our back. So it behooves everybody to look out for us. Because when you look out for us, we look out for everybody. And then, you know, just a reminder that, like, all health is maternal health. That there is no space that does not impact directly maternal health. When we talk about economic justice, that's maternal health. If we're talking about restorative justice, that's maternal health. If you're talking about reproductive, you know, justice, that's maternal health. So all health is maternal health.
But you need to give up your sin. You need to give up your sin.
What time is it? Showtime. What time is it? Showtime. What time is it? Showtime. Tell me what time it is.
It's time for the Birth Justice Podcast NYC, a space for dialogue and debate about one of New York City's most pressing public health and racial justice issues, birth. We're going on a journey across all five boroughs, taking a close, comprehensive, and creative look at how people in New York City experience reproductive oppression, as well as create strategies for their health and for their families. I'm your host, Taja Lindley, a courageous, truth-telling creatress and an unapologetically Black queer femme feminist woman committed to the wellness, creativity, and bodily autonomy of women and girls of color. I'm the daughter of a single mother, eldest of three sisters, and an artist based in Brooklyn. I record from my home so you may hear city sounds in the background. As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast belong to the people who say them. And although we're discussing matters of health, this is not health advice. If you need medical attention or information, please consult healthcare professionals you know and trust. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at BirthJusticeNYC and support our work on Patreon. And now, on to the show. Everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Birth Justice Podcast NYC. Okay, y'all, this is our very last episode of season one, and it's been a wild and amazing ride these last 12 weeks. This is my first time creating a podcast, and I've learned so much along the way. Thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who supported our work as a patron. Shout out to my mama, Adrienne Robinson, who was featured in the first episode, as well as Colleen Beach and Laura Nova for their one-time donations via PayPal. I'm so, so, so grateful for everyone's generosity and support. And thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who has been tuning in and sharing the podcast with your families, communities, and colleagues. In the show notes, you'll find a short listener survey. Please fill it out. Whether you've listened to one episode or all of them, we want to hear from you. Your responses will help us grow, strengthen, and improve content for season two. As a final reminder, if you live in New York City or lived in New York City recently, and you have a story to tell about reproductive health, rights, or justice, a personal story, please fill out our storytelling form. And share it with folks you know who have important stories to tell that will help our city better understand and address medical racism and health inequity. We'll be in touch this fall to chat with folks who filled out the form and to see how and if we can feature you on the podcast. Now, let's jump into this week's episode, the season one finale of the Birth Justice Podcast NYC. We're going out with a bang, featuring the dynamic time-traveling doula, Evelyn Alvarez. She's a mom, a doula, a trainer, and the world's best hype woman. Okay? She is the founder of Bronx Rebirth and Progress Collective. You'll remember that we interviewed the other two co-founders, Carmen Mojica in episode 5 and Nicole Jean Baptiste in episode 9. In this week's episode, Evelyn shares the tales and the tea of being a doula in New York City. From being a witness to advocating with and for clients, Evelyn shows up and shows out for the pregnant and parenting people she serves. She gives us insight on the politics of doula compensation, what is happening in New York City hospitals, how medical routines cause harm, and how our city can do a better job of increasing doula access to clients who want and need them. I promise you, you're in for a treat. Now let's get to it. On to the season finale interview. Welcome, Evelyn, to the podcast. So excited to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
So before we get into what you do, I want to know how you got to doing it. So what brought you to birth work? Give us a brief history.
Sure. Basically, it was my best friend, you know. When I was pregnant, I was like the only one out of my homegirls that had a baby. And I took it.
What time period is this,
if you don't mind? Oh, my son was born in 2005.
Okay.
So I was pregnant in 2004, 2005. And what had happened in my family was that my brother passed away in 2004. And it was like right after he passed away, I got pregnant. So like there was all this turmoil in my family. I was grieving, just found out I was pregnant. I was in this relationship that I wasn't really sure was going to go the distance. And I really didn't have the support of my friends to help me navigate this type of, you know, people are supportive, but like pregnancy is complicated. Right.
Yeah.
And so I turned to the internet and made friends on like websites like Baby Center. So what ended up happening was that when my homegirls, you know, started getting pregnant, you know, several years later, I was asking them all the questions that I felt like I wanted people to ask me. So I would ask them like, girl, you having sex? How your nipples feel? Are you constipated? Right. And they'd be like, ew, you nasty, Ev. Like, you nasty. And then when, let's say we were at brunch and I'm asking these questions, you know, I'd get home and they'd be like, yo, talk to me, Ben, about this constipation, you know? So one day my best friend was like, you should become a doula. And I was like, you know what? I should. But that's also the nature of having really strong sister friends that when they make a suggestion, you take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really grateful for that. And so like that was probably, say that was on a Sunday. On Tuesday, I'm actually chatting on Facebook with one of the moms that I had met on Baby Center. And, you know, in passing, she and I, we probably haven't even had a conversation like that since. But she and I are like talking about life and catching up. And all of a sudden she tells me, I tell her, you know, one of my homegirls, you know, my best friend said I should become a doula. And she goes, wow, my neighbor in Bed-Stuy runs like a doula training agency. So what do we having this conversation on Facebook? It's probably like 12:30 at night. And she goes, yeah, I can't remember the name. I think it's Ancient Song. So I Google Ancient Song, and right on the front page of the website, they had like this this application for a scholarship. I didn't even look at it. And while I'm talking to her, we still talking about raggedy baby daddies and the whole nine yards. And I am like filling out the application. It was really simple, probably like four questions. By the time we got off the, you know, offline, it was maybe 2 o'clock in the morning. I click send on the application and I promptly forgot. I went to sleep and was like, I forgot about it. 2 days later, I get an email from someone at Ancient Song and then a call, and they were like, oh, you applied for this scholarship and the class starts tomorrow.
Wow.
And I was like, wait, what? Wait a minute, what? Right? And that's exactly what happened. So between the time that I was asked to, between the time that I was invited to, it was even suggested to me that I become a doula. I didn't even have that much of an idea of what a doula was. To the time that I started training was less than a week.
Wow. And you were also pregnant during this time too,
no,
right?
I wasn't pregnant. This was years after me being pregnant. So this
gotcha. Year,
by the time I became a doula, my son was about 7 and now he's 15.
Okay, so 2012-ish mm-hmm. is when mm-hmm. you do the doula training.
Yep. And it was, yeah, so it's great. So I rolled up to Ancient Song and I didn't even know what to expect. And they had like all these prereqs that I couldn't do because I got the scholarship on Thursday and the class started on Friday. So, and I didn't have any money. Like, that's a really like funny other story that I was really, really struggling at the time. And so like the book that they had recommended to read, when I Googled it, it was something like $19. Like it was like the birth partner. You know, like that book. And I didn't have $19 to buy the book. So if the class started at like 6, I rolled up to Barnes and Noble at like 3:30 and sat on the floor and read as much of the book that I could read and could take in before I went to Ancient Song.
Wow. You were committed though.
Listen, all right. I was like, yeah, you know, because it just felt right. Yeah. I was that it felt right at the time.
So how was your training at Ancient Song? What really stands out to you about that time?
A couple of things, you know, like I really enjoyed the camaraderie between the other people that were taking the class. So at the time, Ancient Song was a much smaller organization, and it was like in this one little tiny room of the mansion at 375 Stuyvesant. And so it was like a whole bunch of us. And I was just like, wow, like Chanel was out here talking about like tinctures and things that we should look out for. And so that part really like the organicness of it all, right? Like really learning about natural remedies stuck out to me at the time. And again, like, you know, just really collaborating with the people that were there. I really felt like it was such a woman-centered space. Yeah. And I really love that. And I've always loved that. Like, I've always been one of those people who is like, I'm down for like women, right? So, and femmes. So it's like, that felt like my kind of space. And plus at the time I had already moved, I had moved to the Bronx. And so I was a single mom, like running around the city. And every time that I was able to go back to Brooklyn, it just felt right. I was raised in Brooklyn. And so I just felt like, yay, I'm home. I'm home. Like, I remember feeling really, embraced and supported. And I was very grateful about that.
So you've been a doula for about 8 years now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's talk about what you've been witnessing over the course of the 8 years. I'm curious to know first, do you know how many clients you might have had over approximately?
Yes, I've actually had quite a few. I'm slightly over at 100.
Okay. So over 100 births all in New York City?
Mm-hmm. And one in DC.
Okay. All right. So you know a lot about birthing in New York City. Mm-hmm. How many boroughs have you been a doula? Like, how many boroughs have you had to travel to? Can you say that you've been in all five or?
No, four, girl. Ain't nobody going to Staten Island?
Stop. Stop. We're going to get the podcast to Staten Island. I promise.
I know. Shout out to Staten Island. Shout out to Staten Island. But
yeah, so every borough except Staten Island.
Yep.
Okay. And then also, have they all been hospital births? Have some been at home or birthing centers? Like what kind of environments?
About 15% have been home births. So I've basically done hospital births and home births.
Okay. So yeah, let's talk about your experiences as a doula. What are some themes that have come up over the course of the 8 years? Some stuff that you've noticed in New York City spaces with New York City births? Like, what do folks need to know about what you're witnessing on the proverbial front lines pre-COVID? Because we're going to get into post-COVID in a moment.
Yes. So pre-COVID, I think that it's really important for the people to know that I want to believe for myself, and I need to believe for my client, that staff at hospitals want to do the right thing and that they just don't know how, right? That there is, the systems that exist in hospitals and then also the goals of the client don't always align. So really having someone as a doula, I've definitely felt like my role often is to kind of like negotiate a little bit, but not negotiate for my client, but to help my client figure out ways to negotiate for themselves, right? To be able to at least, like, I always think of myself as a doula and I'm like, I stop time wherever possible. So like, if there are options that need to be considered, like how much time do we have for this person to A, know all the options, and then B, be able to consider them, and then C, ask questions about the options that they have, to really support my client. So I would say that in general, and then of course, like I have seen harm. Right. Like, I would be lying if I said that I haven't seen harm. I've seen harm in different ways. Like, I think that often nowadays we're looking a lot toward racial harm. But I've also seen harm in terms of like ageism. Like, for example, a lot of my first few clients were teen moms. It just so happened that like maybe the first five or six were teen moms, and there were a couple of like multiples. Right. So like 15 with twins or 17, you know? And so the expectation that people had, even while trying to be helpful, was actually harmful. Like one situation that stood out to me was one of my first clients. She's 17 and she was laboring. She's about 8 or 9 centimeters dilated. And someone from the hospital asked her, so what kind of birth control are you going to use after this?
While she was in the middle of laboring.
While she was in the middle of laboring, an unmedicated labor. And
unmedicated. Yes. So she's feeling everything.
Right. Unmedicated labor. And the hospital staff came and asked her specifically, like, oh, you know, so what kind of labor, what kind of, you know, what kind of birth control are you going to use after this? And it was like not, and I know that it was a person who was like, oh, you don't want to do this again anytime soon. And it's like, A, how the hell do you know that? Right. And B, not now. Right. So, and my client turns to me and was like, Ev, I'm about to turn up on this lady. I'm about to turn up on this lady. So like, and she's looking at me, you know, and I also, and I could see that this, you know, this, and the person was really shocked at the response that my client had, like, well, I'm just trying to help you kind of thing. And I really thought to myself, like, wow, you really are thinking that this is helpful. Right. So I just injected myself and said, maybe we should have this conversation a little bit later, maybe tomorrow. Right. Like, you know, come back tomorrow and maybe not tomorrow, but I'm sure she'll discuss it, you know, or she'll discuss it with her doctor when she goes in for the postpartum visit. Like, we don't have to think about this right now. But it was, you know, and then I also had to do some work to like manage my voice because I was equally as annoyed, but like being that person. And so, you know, they walk away and my client is like, yo, you already know how I do, Ev. I was about to turn all the way up. She lucky that, oh, you know, and then she starts getting a contraction and never really finished the statement. But I mean, I always make people laugh with some of the stories because honestly, the stories that stand out for me are the stories where people are like just black AF and just really like funny. I had this one woman that was like, Ev, pin down my wig, pin down my wig, right? And so and of all the things that, you know, that stand out at the time, like, you know, they it's another unmedicated birth. And this person is asking me about like their wig being pinned down. So that part has been, that was really, really funny. And I didn't have any pins. So I'm like, what the fuck am I gonna do? Like, but then I thought like, oh, I have pins in my own head. Like I literally took the pins out of my own bun and was like, I got you, sis. Cause you know, that's important. Whatever you want to censor when you're having labor, like that's what I censor. But yeah.
Yeah. I feel like doulas, and especially you, like you really got to call on what you got to really support the folks who are birthing and laboring, you know, like it's, what do I have? You know, you got it. For folks who are listening, who may not understand, I just want to like explain a little bit, like, you know, why asking someone during active labor, asking them about birth control options is inappropriate and also problematic because the way it's part of it is this person is giving birth. They're in the midst of some contractions and to ask them about something that is not about what is going on currently is really challenging because it's like, I'm focused on this. Why are you asking me about that? And there's a long history of that, right? In the US,
yep.
Of asking people to do things, including signing documents around, you know, sterilization or giving so-called consent when they're in the midst of feeling, you know, just physically they're in it, you know, they could be feeling agitated. They can feel pain. There's all different kinds of ways that people explain what they're experiencing. But the fact of the matter is that it does require a lot of focus and attention. That's also why you're there as a doula.
Yep.
And to be asking someone about birth control during that time, you know, is just not appropriate. On top of that, you mentioned that this person is a teen parent. So I just want folks to know, like, there is this desire to control people's reproductive lives, control when and how people get pregnant. And that's across the board, but especially with teenagers. And so, sure, if you want to support people with knowing about what their options are so that they can make powerful choices for themselves, that's great. But to do that during active labor suggests that the person who was asking had concerns about the person's age who was giving birth and wanted to make sure that they didn't give birth again anytime soon. And that's, you know, coercion. That's reproductive control.
Yep. So it's just been, so I think that, yeah, definitely there've been some things that I've seen at hospitals, like a lot of, as a doula, I've certainly had my share of people who, like hospital staff who felt uncomfortable with my presence.
How do you know they were uncomfortable with your presence? And why do you think they were uncomfortable with it?
I mean, there are times when they've literally said it.
I'm uncomfortable with you here.
Like, or something along the lines of like, well, you don't really need a doula. Like, I don't know why they have them here. Or, you know, this person needs to leave the room. So, for example, there have been situations where like my client, they may say, oh, things have taken a turn and we need to talk to you. And my doula, you know, my client will say, oh, my doula and I will stay here. And they'll say, oh, no, they need to leave.
Wow.
So they have definitely.
They need to leave.
Right. Like they need to leave or something along those lines. And so it's been challenging. And a lot of my doulas a lot of my clients have also been Spanish speaking. And so.
Because you're a Spanish speaker.
I am a Spanish speaker. And so being able to support families who also, because it's beyond the language, it's also the jargon.
Yeah.
So being able to support someone in translating the jargon, even if it's in the language that you speak, there's lots of information that they're going to give you. Oh, we're going to give you XYZ medication and we're going to give you, you know, 5 cc's. And it's just like, what?
What does that mean? What is five cc's?
Right. Yeah. I don't even know what that is or how I'm supposed to really think about that. Or what does Pitocin do? Right. And they just sometimes give these really fast, not really thoughtful descriptions or information or explanations about what it is that people will potentially experience. Oh, we're just going to get you started on, you know, two next.
Yeah. And it's like, does the person understand what that means? So it's more than just speaking in someone's language. It's about really making sure you're understood.
Right. And so really being able to even say, and you know, sometimes like, and then also the way that things work is that people have, in general, a lot of my clients have been really intimidated by the medical system already. So even when people ask them, so do you have any questions? Yes, they have questions, but they haven't built a relationship with you. So they don't know that they trust you to give the right answer. Right. Yeah. And so often they'll look at me and say things like, did you understand that? And they'll say, you know, they might say yes to the medical professional. And then when I come in, you know, when they leave, they'll say, I didn't really understand that, girl. Like, just break that down for me.
Right. Because they have a relationship with you, but they don't have a relationship with the provider.
Exactly. So that is something that I think happens quite a bit. And so as a doula, like, that's one of the things that I know that I support my client and I really stand up for them in that way, or even just to say, wow, you know what? If there's another question, let's wait, let's call the nurse back just so that we can get some more information. And when the nurse comes back, I'll start the question asking. And then as the, you know, as they start answering questions, then I'll specifically turn to my client and say like, do you have any other questions? And often they will ask another question that they already had. But now it's like a little bit of the relationship has been navigated so that they can feel safer asking the question too.
Yeah. You know, I feel like this shows up not just in gynecological care, labor and delivery, or prenatal care. Like I had a friend who was having a knee surgery and she asked me to go with her, not because she was scared of her doctor or anything like that, but she needed another person there to help her take notes, to help her remember what was said, to, you know, just be by her side. And I feel like, you know, maybe that was being a doula in a way, even though that wasn't necessarily the title.
Most definitely.
But there is this, you know, when you're alone with medical professionals, there is this, desire and need to have someone else there to support you in asking your questions, remembering what was said, and also processing the experience.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is because I feel like there's so many different reasons, but, you know, part of it is a lot of the things that you were talking about. You know, if your appointment is rushed, if you're feeling like, you know, you don't have a lot of time, or if you don't have a relationship with that provider, because it seems like, you know, maternal health care in New York City is very piecemeal. You go here for prenatal care, you go here to deliver, you know, you're not necessarily with the same people throughout. Some of that is because of the nature of birth. Like, you know, if it's not scheduled, it can happen at a time when someone's not available, but also because our system is very like sort of piecemeal too.
Yeah. And I, you know, we call like one of my close friends and I, we call it being a witness. You know, especially like in certain environments, you have an experience with someone, like, I think about it all the time, even in environments where harm is any environment where harm is being caused to Black people. Let's say like you're an only, right? And then there's another Black person and something happens and you look at them like, did you see that?
Yeah.
Right. And so being able to have that other person be a witness, because sometimes you need somebody to hear, to tell you, nah, that wasn't crazy.
Right.
You know, that was raggedy. Or I heard it too. Right. Because that affirms you. That makes you feel like, wow, like maybe I'm not, especially when you've been from a marginalized, you know, community where you have not had a historic space to be able to feel comfortable to show up. Then all of a sudden, you know, just to tell your client, well, you can ask questions or go ahead. Like, that's not enough, because you have to undo a lifetime of being told that they don't matter.
Yeah. And other situations and instances that people have had with healthcare right. that might be impacting like how they're navigating it now, whether that's fear-based or distrust.
And just in life, right? So it's like, if you've been shut down in many ways, family, in school, at work, all of these spaces, it's unlikely that this person is also going to develop the skill necessary to be able to show up for themselves, right? Because the way that you do one thing, in my opinion, is the way that you do everything. Yeah. So it's like, that is, it's really important to recognize that that's another reason why people don't often speak, because they've also been taught that their voice doesn't matter, even for themselves.
I think there's also this dynamic where medical professionals, like they're an authority on a particular topic. So even though you've been with your body for a lifetime and you understand like how some things may not feel right or not seem right. And there could just be this dynamic where, you know, you're talking to someone who has a degree, you know, a nurse, a doctor, you know, other practitioners, and can feel like they're the authority on something. So even if something doesn't feel right, like really doing that push, that self-advocacy can be, you know, can be challenging.
And being there for someone and helping them to really be firm in the idea that when it doesn't feel right, it doesn't feel, it's not right. Right. Like years ago, there was this movie. It was like one of them cheesy little, like it was, you know, I remember the name of the movie being Ronin, right? Maybe some of the listeners have heard it, but it was like, one of the lines that always stood out for me is like, if there's doubt, then there's no doubt. And I always thought that if there's doubt that something is not feeling right, then there's no doubt that you should act on it.
Mm.
Even if you end up at the same place, at least you know that you've honored yourself by acting on what it is that you knew was, you know, that there was a doubt there. And I find that when I, in life, when I've been able to act on that little feeling, I'm not really sure. So often when I act on it, I actually end up being right. Right? Like my spirit is telling me. And I think that when you think about people who have been gaslighted, right, into like believing that what they experience is not really an experience, like say like Amber Rose, the tweet, you know, where she was like, these people ain't treating me right. And then she ended up passing away. Like, what would it have been like if she would have been able to have support to be able to say, no, I don't feel right. Like, this is, y'all need to center this. And so that's a really important piece for me.
Yeah. So you were mentioning that you've witnessed it. You've witnessed instances where medical staff may think they're being helpful, but they can actually be causing harm or creating a challenging birthing experience. Can you give some more examples of like what that's looked like and how that's shown up?
It shows up a lot in, for example, people asking questions about what's happening with their body and then just being rushed.
Okay.
So in another instance, I had a situation where after the vaginal delivery, the birthing person said, what's happening? Right. And again, these are like thinking about the first few births. I'm going all the way back to the beginning. But like, what's happening? Because there was afterward, you know, like after a birth, the midwife or OB looks at the person's, the birthing person's genitals to make sure that there aren't any tears or anything along those lines. And so typically if there are any, tears, then they start to like, sew them. Right. So there's like a, right, there's, and the birthing person should have the right to ask, what are you doing to my body?
Yeah, and to know.
And to know, and to have the person say, well, this is what's happening. This is what, you know, you had a slight tear here, and this is what we're going to do. We're going to do a couple of stitches to make sure that. And the again, the birthing, you know, like the medical provider was just like, they said, I'm, you know, you had a tear and I'm tying it. And cause I know you're going to want to use it again.
Oh gosh.
And it was like, we ain't cool like that. Like, what do you, and you know, chances are maybe she wants to use it again. Maybe she doesn't, but like this assumption that like, oh, you have to fix, or that you don't have to tell her what it is that you're doing to her own body, right? To their own body. So that was super, and I feel like I've experienced a lot of that, like rushing people past like the question or dismissing their experience, right? Oh, it's just that you're being like, oh, or suggesting that people are not strong because of the way that they're managing their pain, right? So as soon as someone says, oh, you are, you know, like you are, like you're only at 4 centimeters, like why do you want pain medication now? You know, like those types of questions of like really like a reduction of people experiencing their own, of managing their own pain. Like that's been something that I've seen. I've seen harm in the sense of just not showing up, or, and you know, like for example, like my client might call a nurse for something specific and like people will delay showing up. Yeah, just lots of different,
like taking their time to come to the room for the thing right. that the client was asking for.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, just not showing any type of urgency or prioritization toward certain things. Asking for like partners that may or may not show up.
What do you mean asking like, for partners?
Like, oh, so is dad coming?
Yeah, and that could be a tricky situation, right. especially if you're not privy to what the relationship mm-hmm. with the father is or is not, or if there even is a father. Like, there's right. just so many different ways that people get pregnant.
Exactly. So just asking those types of questions that really sometimes can make someone feel unseen. I had one birth that was with a trans man. My client was a trans man, and they kept telling me, please ask them not to say mom, right?
Your client is asking you to tell
the staff not to say mom, to if they're going to address me, to please say like, you know, Joey, for example.
Okay. Like use their name or
use
something.
Their name, mm-hmm. right. Or not use, or just use the pronoun that the person has the preferred pronoun.
Yeah.
And there was just, and it was like 9 hours of refusal to use the pronoun, and to everybody that came in the room, hey mom, how's she doing? Hey, you know, are you okay? And again, it was like this, it was warmth in the tone, but just complete dismissal of the request.
Yeah. It's like this, it sounds like too, maybe that is part of the routine of their job. Like they'll come right. into the room and be like, hey mom, how you doing? Like right. as a way to be friendly, as a way to be accessible. But in right. this instance, it's actually not friendly. It is right. going against how this person identifies and what they've requested.
Exactly. And so my role there for a lot of the time was when they would come in and say, hey mom, I'd be like, Joey, you know, please make sure, yeah. you know, please remember to call. It got to the point where I was kind of standing closer to the door, like, remember, it's Joey. You know, because they're feeling, you know, they're feeling highly triggered and really unseen and unsupported by the constant refusal of people to not recognize that this is the way that they want to be addressed.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I think that you speak to a really important point, which is that the lack of recognition of how routine can cause harm is a big barrier, right? So this lack of being able to be reflective and then using time as a way of like, well, we don't have time, right? So time becomes a tool of oppression, because if you don't have time all the time, then you, I need you to take time. right? I need you to not rush me through my process. I need you to not feel like, oh, because you don't have time, that means that you don't prioritize learning about me or even implementing small things that can have great impact. So for example, commitment to even using gender neutral pronouns is one thing that people can do and train themselves to do that can have big impact. But that kind of just sticking to routines is also what historically has caused harm, because routines that are set are the routines that we know don't often work for Black birthing people.
Something else that I was thinking while you were talking, like this thing around time, because what time is also, how time is organized inside of a hospital setting isn't always dictated by the people who are delivering the care too. That, you know, how many people are, you know, staffed for the ward at the time, how many people are available to support whatever number of birthing people. I'm not really sure what a good ratio is supposed to be, but I know that if a hospital is understaffed, or if the demand doesn't meet the supply, like if the demand of birthing people doesn't meet the supply, then it makes an impact on how people are able to deliver care. And those decisions are made administratively and then trickle down. And I just wanted to bring that up. I'm not saying that's the case for every time people get rushed inside of their appointments, but just to point to how a structure reinforces a problem that exists, right? That how something is organized, the time that is allowed or expected for people to give to patients impacts how people are able to show up. So even perhaps someone who might be well-intentioned and may want to spend more time may feel pressed for time because of all of this stuff. Now, I'm not saying it's right. I just wanted to provide some context for folks to understand, too, that some of it is a sort of rush along, you know, dot the I's, cross the T's, check the boxes, get it moving, or other things that are going on. But then this other part you're talking about is a willingness. Because if you ain't got enough time, well, then, you know, look at the chart. What does the chart say? The chart says the person's name. Hopefully it also has the person's pronoun too, which is also a structural thing. It's just like, how is information being passed between people so that the doula doesn't have to stand at the door to remind people how to interact with the patient or the client? You know, how can you be more integrated with the client's experience instead of having to do this negotiating thing? But I think a lot of folks do call on doulas to support them with negotiating these systems that they either feel neglected by, abused by, or just not very connected to relationship-wise.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that is, we recognize the value, but we don't want to commit the resources to be able to make it happen, which is, again, doubly offensive. Like, I know that we should be working on this, but I mean,
we don't have the time,
or it's just too much to do, right? Literally last week, I asked a person who was like a head OB at a large hospital here in New York City, what is your commitment to neutralizing your language?
In terms of gender language.
And I was completely brushed off. It was like, oh, well, yeah, I know that's a thing, but we just don't do that here. Or we haven't really been able to prioritize that, or we don't. Or most of our clients don't need that type of, and at the time I was in a group meeting with other people. And so what was really difficult was that when you are the only, because I wanted to really push back, and people were like, well, just, you know, if that's not what happens there. And I'm like, that's not okay. But that also,
because it will happen. It can happen. It probably does happen.
Exactly. And so again, the community that you work with is not a community that you're riding on the fact that people are not going to argue back with you on this, but it is actually something that you can commit to doing at every level to be able to make people feel welcomed and included. And if they do that, then they're more likely to tell you what issues they have so that you can actually have the effect that they actually want, that you want to have with them. So then you'll say like, oh, well, they're not speaking much. They're not showing up for appointments. And the things that make people feel like they want to show up for appointments are the things that make people feel valued. I feel seen as a complete and whole individual.
And people can avoid appointments or will avoid appointments if they don't feel seen, if they don't feel heard, if they don't feel like the care is missing in the healthcare, you know? I'm curious about some things that have worked well, but since we're on this path, you know, what have been some of the more egregious things that you've witnessed in labor, delivery, postpartum, pregnancy, while being a doula?
Oh, man. I want to say, one of the most egregious things that I've seen are just a lot of dismissal and care, right? Like if a client is making a specific request for their own body, like I had a client who was told, if you don't progress in 45 minutes, we're going to give you a C-section. And that tension of them having to now almost like will their body to do something caused so much
in 45 minutes.
Again, it's like that misuse of time, that feeling that they're already like, oh my goodness, like if you don't do this by this time, then we're going to have to take over. Like you lose agency over your body. Really like just, I think the strong threats around, or I mean, all right. So one time I had a client who she was pushing was difficult for her. And we found out later that it was for a lot of different reasons, but the doctor comes in and was like, oh, so I heard that you've been pushing and they haven't really been making progress. Don't worry about it. You know, just let me give you a C-section. I've had three. And anyway, you get to preserve your pelvic floor. Like you don't have, you know, this is not, you don't have to do this. And it was just such a dismissal of the way that this person had actually had planned, like not even on some, okay, let's try this. Like, let's try an alternative. Let's move you this way. But it was just like, no, like, why are we even going to make this effort? Like, just let's get over this hump. And I was really shocked at the way that this doctor just kind of came in and was just like, preserve your pelvic floor. I've had three of them. And, you know, like, it'll be great. You'll have your baby in half an hour. Let's go. So that part of just really being cavalier about major surgery was also really shocking to me. So I think that a lot of the more egregious things that I've seen beyond, like, have not been physical, just the real dismissal of including the birthing person in the choices for their own experience and their own life.
Right. And prioritizing what their desires are, mm-hmm. for how they want to be referred, yes. to, how they'd like to give birth. Yes, there are reasons why C-sections can be medically necessary, but the data shows that it is overused. You know, every time it's used is not every time it's needed.
Exactly. And so like that part has been really difficult, and like just a lack of explanation, a lack of really including the client in their own experience to the point that later on they're like, did that really happen? Like, I didn't even know what to say when they came in and they rushed me and they said me that I have to do it right now. Like, five people are rushing into the room with no explanation of why these people are here. And they're telling me that I need to do this right now. Like, that abuse of including the client, particularly when it's not a dire emergency.
Yeah. And I just want to clarify for folks, because I don't think we explained this earlier, most, if not all of your clients have been Black and brown people in New York. Absolutely. City, right? Have you noticed any differences across the boroughs? Like, is Queens getting a better deal than the Bronx? You know, are there any borough specific things that you've noticed or witnessed?
Not really. I would say that like, it's not borough specific. It's maybe location specific.
Like the hospital, right,
like
itself.
The hospital itself, or where people actually want to go. But like, it's always surprising to me because I feel like the places that have become really popular, like baby hospitals in New York City, like for example, like a Mount Sinai West, people seem to like to go there. But I don't necessarily feel like it's better than a North Central, which doesn't get a good rep because it's a city hospital, because it's located kind of in the hood. Like, so those types of things I think are often surprising to me, how the warmest places that I've been that have had a midwifery centered models of care have also been hospitals that people kind of frown upon, and the hospitals that are kind of expected to be maybe more high end or safer have been places where more of my clients have ended up in C-sections that may or may not have been necessary.
And what have been some things that have worked really well for your clients? What are ways in which you've seen medical providers show up in ways that supported the birthing experience and the decision-making of the birthing person?
Definitely when the medical providers that have asked questions first and stayed to hear the answer, really said, for example, "Oh, I don't know. Let me go find out," or something along those lines. Like, not really tried to make things up on the fly, just to give an answer. The medical providers with whom, when my clients have been able to have a continuity of care, so the midwife, for example, that they see at their appointment is also the midwife that that helps them, or they've seen all of the members of that midwifery team. So that they feel confident when they're going into birth, like, oh, my doctor's going to be there, or the person that I saw is going to is on call this particular day, or they've prepared me in this particular way. I think that has been really helpful for my clients. Being able to, again, like just being, I think as a doula, like doing the front end work of really being able to preview things with your clients so that they can have a little bit of a process of what they're going to ask. So for example, I like to say, like, if this happens, then we're going to ask this. If that happens, then we're going to ask that. And so those kind of things, so that they come in already with like an arsenal of questions that they can ask, or an arsenal of experiences that they have, that they're confident about. The creation of a birthing plan and sharing that plan, even though often birthing plans are kind of like, ha, whatevs. But I think that having the client be prepared with an example of what it is that they want is really helpful on the front end. And I think that depending on the space and who's on duty that time, and also what's happening in that space, that they also get to have a better overall experience.
Yeah. And you've been doing this work for a while, so about 8 years. Have you noticed any differences across time between 2012 and now, besides COVID? Because we'll talk about COVID in a moment, but have there been any changes or things very, you know, this more of the same?
You know what? I mean, it's different. I think that things have changed, hopefully for the better, because of advocacy. I think that the role of advocacy has been really, really, really important in terms of helping people. And by people, I mean like hospital admin, recognize that people out here, right, they're listening. The support of doulas, I think, has increased. Not everywhere is it the same, but I think that most hospitals now at least will say like, oh, we are supportive of doulas, or we recognize the inclusion of doulas as as being part of the birth team and not included. So for example, like say, it used to be that people would have like two people that they could have as, you know, during the labor. And a lot of places now have not included that doula as a second person, so that technically you could have three, which is really, really helpful, right? So for some people, often like, I've had clients that they might have their partner and a sister or their mom. And so historically, where they would have had to make that choice to be like, it's either your partner or your mom and the doula, now they can have their partner, their mom, and the doula there, which is really great for support. So yeah, I think that those types of things really, as a doula, the inclusion or what feels like more consistent comfort with the presence of a doula is something that is a positive move.
It doesn't feel as hostile as it might have felt like back in 2012. It
definitely felt hostile in 2012. And I felt like I had to really do more to kind of prove my value in a way in the process. Whereas now, some of the places that I've been most recently have been really encouraging of my presence. And they've been really like including me as part of the, oh, you know, this is what we're going to be doing now. Or like, and I also make it a point to be really present and kind to the staff there, because what I do recognize is that if things go wrong, if shit goes left, the people that we get to blame are not always the people that made the decisions. To your point about administrative decisions being like the people that have to do some of this raggedy work or implementations, they are equally as frustrated often by the decisions that administrative teams have made. They just have to do it in order to keep their job. So recognizing that has been really helpful for me as well.
Got it. And so how has your work changed since COVID hit? Like what things are feeling and looking different in terms of supporting birthing people?
I mean, well, immediately after COVID hit, doulas couldn't go into hospitals. So, and birthing people were going into hospitals by themselves, right? In some hospitals. So that was really, really difficult, and providing virtual care. And then being able to convince clients at times that virtual care was really supportive, right? Because people are like, well, if you can't be here, you know, I know that there are some doulas who had issues with clients saying like, oh, if you can't be here, then like, what's the point? Or what's your fee for, type of thing. But also just really continuing that care with clients, because so much of the doula work is really like hands-on physically, right? Like I'm out here giving hip squeezes. I am, you know, holding hands and wiping tears and feeding ice. And, you know, I'm always like, one of my funniest moments was when at one point as a doula, there's been a couple times and this happens, but like I've had somebody's leg on my, you know, like holding somebody's leg up, and then also like dabbing the tears of partners or mom, right? And I wish you all could see me right now who are listening to this podcast, but it's literally like one hand has a foot in it and the other hand has like a, you know, like a tissue, and I'm dabbing tears, right? Like, so not being able to do that is really helpful. And then also being able to help my clients navigate pain at home. So that you do a lot of work of like management. I've done 4 births virtually since COVID hit. And so in each one, it's being able to like, I'm in front of the computer on FaceTime with my client for hours, like, right? And let me tell you, because there are going to be people that are like, oh, well, you virtual, you at home, you sitting in your underwear, no bra, you comfy girl, right? But it is exhausting to spend 8 hours talking about some, breathe, slow down. All right. When I tell you my throat is all kind of dry, I am exhausted, honey. Like it's just, it's big things are going on here. Right. So it is like, oh snap. And you're also doing this at like 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, you know? So it definitely has been difficult because there's a lot more preparation. There's a lot of, and that requires also even more deposits into the relationships that you make with your clients, so that when they turn to this, so when they have, when they're in labor, they can really turn to you and say like, Ev, this is something, right? Because it's awkward to be holding the phone for 6 hours, or to have somebody hold the phone for 6 hours while you're actually communicating with your doula, or introducing your doula to the hospital staff and turning your phone or turning your iPad, right? So that has been difficult, but it has not been impossible. And I think that by all accounts, not just myself, but other doulas that I know that have been doing virtual work, it's been super successful. Like we're also now helping the client stay home longer to be able to be in the hospital less time. So that's another thing too, that we're also helping manage pain verbally, right? Giving, so it requires like a lot of the front end things that I would be there to show a client and their partner or whomever their birthing team is. Now we have to do that like through Zoom. And so all of that has been really shifting. But, you know, like my last 2 clients, they were able to go to the hospital and be like 6 and 7 centimeters dilated. So that was actually really great. They've been able to have the unmedicated births that they really wanted. And so I feel a lot of happiness for them and pride for the systems that we created.
Yeah. And you're just as present virtually, you know, present, as you would be in person.
I'm present the entire time. And also it, what it has done, which is, you know, interestingly enough, is that it has also enabled me to have different relationships with partners in a way that I would not have, because partners become so important in this point, right? So often the partners, and again, the partners don't have to be like the romantic partners, but like whether it be the sister or whether it be the best friend, what do I do, Ev? You know, help me. And so, and that's really great, because often the partners have been people that have had births themselves, which you would automatically think like, oh, you know what to do. And they'd be like, nah, girl, I ain't never been on this side. Tell me what to do. So it's been a lot of that, and that's been really fun too.
Yeah. And I think that brings up how doulas not only support birthing people, but can really support the whole community and family that comes together around that birthing person as well.
It's really important. I mean, even if, you know, in the event that they don't have a specific community, like really helping them to design or create one, right? Because this work, parenting is best when you don't have to do it by yourself, right? So how do you build your community? In my case, like I told you at the beginning, that when I became pregnant and really didn't have, like, I had close friends, obviously, that were here physically, but I also wanted people with whom I could share an experience, right? People that I knew were going to be potentially up at 2-3 o'clock in the morning to just talk smack with and be like, oh, my breast hurt. Or I got, oh, wow, look at me. I pumped. It was 12 ounces today, you know? so really having that. And so helping clients also create that for themselves is helpful as well.
Yeah. So in addition to, we've talked a lot about you being a doula. That was, you know, a big part of this episode, mm-hmm. but I wanted to give you some time to talk a little bit about some other things that you do outside of being a doula that supports birthing people and families.
Oh, cool beans. So I'm really excited because most recently I've become a co-founder of Bronx Rebirth and Progress. Brah, brah, brah. And
blah, blah, blah.
So
BX, stand up. What up?
So it's been super exciting because I get to work with two amazing people, Carmen and Nicole, who have also, you know,
also guests on the podcast.
Yay. So these are like badass people. And essentially what happened is that Carmen called, you know, and what's really great also about being a doula is to be able to find other doulas that have similar ideology, and that, you know, you kind of like navigate, y'all like sharks, like looking at each other, like, all right, I see you, sis. Like, yes, right? I see how you are. And it's funny because Nicole, Carmen, and I had already had a relationship. So Carmen is a midwife also. And I have at times, like if I've had a really difficult birth, there have been times where I've called Carmen, like, help me navigate this, right? Help me to debrief, you know, like help me navigate and help me unpackage this. And also, like I said, that I am ratchet ass doula. I'm going to play, Wipe Me Down and, you know, Stoka as part of my playlist, but I also recognize that not all clients want that type of energy. Right. And so Nicole has almost always been my doula that I refer to when people are like super chill. I'm always like, if you're super chill, I have someone for you. And if you want your birth to feel like the club and you want to wear gold poom poom shorts under your you know, that I might be the person for you. So it's,
yes.
So we already had a relationship with one another, and you know, just really thinking about the way that different people do different things, you know, like this is off topic and I'm going to respond to your question, but like I also trained with the Doula Project. And so what was really funny was that when I trained for the Doula Project, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, but you came in to talk to us like toward the end of the training. And I was already feeling like, where the Black people at? Right. over here. So it was definitely a thing for me. And so to see you show up in that space was also really, really important and powerful for me, because I was like, oh, all right, there are Black women that are doing this, this work in this particular space, which is the termination support space. So
right.
That was like also really, it was so important. And I know that that's one of the things that I've really enjoyed most, is really being able to not just find people who are like-minded, but also recognize that when you as a doula share your experiences, that I have so many people that have been like, oh, I want to become a doula now, because you speak so favorably about this work. And I'm not going to say that doula work is for everybody, but I am excited about the fact that people want to join and be able to support birthing people in this particular way.
So many people want to become doulas now, or are doulas, or like they've already trained, right. And it's so wonderful to see. I remember when I trained, I didn't even know what a doula was. Like nobody was really talking about it. It just felt like so, and this is like 2007 when I started to learn about what a doula was and being like, oh, I think that might be something I might be interested in. But now it's like doula this, doula that. There's like the proliferation of doulas, and it's lovely to see.
It's lovely. Yeah. It's lovely. And I think that it's also, it's lovely, period, right? Period, poo. It's lovely. And then I also think that it's really important for us to do the work to support clients and not suggest, you know, doulas are not, like I was thinking about it. So I ain't a security guard. I'm a doula, right? So really being able to also center the support that we're giving clients is super important in healing. But yeah, so it's like the question was, tell me again.
About what you've been doing outside of being a doula that supports birthing people and
family. My favorite shit right now, right? Which is being the co-founder of Bronx Rebirth and Progress. And so what we do is right now we started off with Carmen giving both Nicole and I a call and being like, what y'all doing? People out here during COVID and lost jobs. And I really want to start a project where we are able to give out diapers and formula to people that need it. We did that. And, you know, Nicole and I were both like, yeah, hell yeah. You know, duh, this is a no-brainer. This is easy that we would get together and collaborate. And so we were able to raise money and be able to support families. And so, like, develop systems where we are able to support families. And to date, we've donated to about 150 families in about a month, in a little bit over a month. And so we are so grateful and excited about the opportunities that we've had to be able to support families locally, and really grateful for the way that we've been able to put our marker in the mutual aid space of recognizing what is necessary and then being able to tap into community, and community has responded in such an amazing way. So now what we're doing is we're moving from just doing the diapers and formula, and shout out to people like Aaron Miles Cloud, who immediately signed on to be like, yeah, I'm gonna help y'all, like, in whatever way I can help you. So it's really a network of like badass people who are doing amazing things, who have without fail shown up and offered advice, support, resources, skills, talents, and time to help us make this work. And so it enables us to really like think bigger. I think that overarchingly what we do is Nicole is amazing at doing some advocacy. She was already on the ground supporting Bruce with like the, you know, with everything that he has needed since Amber Rose's unfortunate and untimely death. Carmen is out here talking about all types of stuff all the time, like talking about just like physical, just Carmen is Carmen, right? And she's badass and bold and amazing. And then I've been out here just really thinking about like just micro shit. Like, so you need food? What are we going to do to get you food, right? You need a doula? Surely. A lot of those births that I've had, I've been able to accumulate a lot of births. A, because I might be like the whisperer. Like, literally, when people ask me, like, oh, back me up, you know, my client ain't going into labor yet, but I have, you know, there are 38 weeks, I'm chilling, I'm about to go out for the night, I bet you that person is going to go into labor, and I'm going to be right there, right? So it is, you know, like, that's really been my space of doing, like, small things with great love in community, and I think that it's really been great when you find people who are also able to collaborate and just be committed to being great for community. Like, we're all community doulas. We all do this work, right, on a really local level. Like, I'm not out here. My clients, a lot of them have been historically court involved. They've lived in transitional housing. They are, like, they regular degulas, right, like Cardi B said. So it's really nice to be able to offer them something different. And so right now we're moving into the establishment of a doula corps, where we're going to be able to also offer support and mentorship to new doulas, as well as just the opportunity to take on clients so that you can build your portfolio and learn as a doula and learn and also be supported, right? Have that debrief opportunity that we've been talking about. So that when you experience challenging things or great things, that they don't just sit with you. I joke all the time that, like, after my first birth, which was at Methodist Hospital in Brooklyn, I remember getting on a bus and I felt like I needed a cape. Like, I was just like, yo, what's good? Right? So I get on the bus and I'm like standing there. I climbed the 3 stairs on a bus and I literally just stand there. And when I stood there, the bus driver's like, what you doing? And I'm giving him like the giddiest smile, like, you'll never guess what I did. I just helped someone have a baby. And he don't even turn around. He was like, all right, you got a Metro card? And I just felt so sad that I was just like, nobody can talk to me about this. Like, I feel so happy right now. Like, I have like that post-birth like joy, right? I'm all like, I need to talk to somebody about how it feels to see that baby crown, right? There, and you're like, ooh, like, you know, you all doing Kegels your damn self. You're like, yes, like, my face is crunched up, my whole body is tense, like, I am all over the place. It's like playing Twister with somebody else, right? You are convincing people that they can do things that they are so scared of, that they are like, I can't do this. You know, every doula, right, is like out here, like, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. And you're like, yes, you can, yes, you can, yes, you can. And so whether it's, and, you know, in your birth doulaing or you're like life doulaing, right, like postpartum doula, you're convincing, you know, you're reminding parents of all the strength that they have to be able to create the life that they want for themselves and their children. And so as part of Rebirth, you know, Bronx Rebirth in Progress, we're able to do that. In addition to being able to support just the expansion of birthing options in the Bronx and in the city of New York, period. Because we have very limited ways that we can also, that we are able to birth here. And then also thinking about the fact that part of the reason why we have such limited ways is because we just don't have enough home birth midwives, right? We don't have enough midwives, period. So what can we also do to be able to support people, particularly Black people that want to get into midwifery? Because the reality is that getting into school is not often the issue. It's staying in school, right? What are the things need to be able to support people? Sometimes you need somebody to just hit you off with a weekly Metro card. That shit is transformative. That shit is transformational. Like, oh snap, now you done freed me up for, you know, $30, and now I can go and buy groceries so I can eat. And if I have to make a choice between buying groceries, and that's just the very real reality of people that are in school. And, you know, I think, like, especially if you are a career changer, which often midwives are, like, you may not even start this work until you turn like 40. Years ago, I went to take, I went to take the pre-nursing exam because I applied to nursing school. And what ended up happening was that, I was probably the youngest person, one of the youngest people in the room. And I was about 35 at the time. And I ended up doing really well in the pre-exam to be able to, like, you know, these are like the SAT, I guess, right? Equivalent. And, but I couldn't afford to take 2 years off work to go to nursing school. So if I can utilize whatever talent and skill I have to give somebody else the opportunity that they can utilize to take, to learn and to be able to expand this field so that we have more birthing options for people in general. If we can use all of the acquired experiences that we've had to help people navigate their bodies, to learn more, right? So that when, and really thinking about how we can expand our program to include like people that are in the preconception phase, to include, to dismantle the ideas that we have about Black and Brown people not being good at science, which is one of the reasons why people don't join the medical field in the first place, right? All of that is stuff that we really want to do and hope to do in the immediate and, you know, near future.
Yeah. And I love that in your response to that question, you were sort of responding to some other questions I had about sort of like what can be done, what should be done in terms of making some moves that move us towards eliminating these health disparities that exist, these health inequities between Black birthing people and white birthing people. I wanted to ask before we close, you know, what are ways that people, namely institutions, can better support doulas and doula access?
They can prioritize it, right? They can, I mean, and also just invite us in. I've done some work, particularly like metropolitan hospitals, where they have had ground rounds where they've had doulas in to talk and to speak to staff. About what it is that we do and how it is that we can help them. And I'm always, you know, and this has happened like in the last 6 months, and I've been amazed at how in awe some of the nurses were. In fact, we had a few nurses that were like, oh, I want to become a doula. Yeah. Right. And so recognizing that there is a difference, but that it is very collaborative, right? I always say doula needs a marketing makeover. Like, doula support needs a marketing makeover so that people don't see it as, oh, these doulas are coming in and giving bad advice, or that they're giving, like, it is very much a collaborative thing. If I'm in your space, like, we want to work together, right? Our goal is to be able to help this person have a birth that doesn't cause harm, that meets their goals as much as possible. and there's room for that. So I think that definitely hospitals should not, the branding that doula support has had, and it's not like this old, like, crunchy, you know, and not all doulas are like that. Like, some of them are super, like, you know, feel crunchy all the time, right? But, like, like people often believe that they can't have a doula if they want a hospital birth, right? Like, oh, I thought doulas were only for home births. That's a real big, that's a big misconception. So really recognizing that doula support goes beyond just like offering red raspberry leaf tea, right? That we do a lot of, know, and being able to help people understand. And by people, I mean everybody, including people who you expect to know about doula support and what that can, and how that could improve outcomes. But yeah, like that's, to me, that's exactly it. Like, just really having conversation, really talking to patients that have had doulas to really be able to talk about their experience. If you need to have that type of, sometimes people need to be convinced, right?
Yeah.
And which is annoying, but I recognize that at this juncture in time, like, that's part of the expectation that people have. But yeah, definitely, like, just including doulas, not seeing them as enemies, but actually as part of the team. And for doulas to show up, I think, and be like their best, bad, bold selves, because I think that's also so necessary, like, to be supportive and to take notes so that when, you know, because people often talk about, like, they're dependent on, like, this data. And I think if doulas were able to get together and be like, yo, with my support, like, this is what happened. You know, these are, like, out of 100 births, I've had 8 that went to section. Those numbers are better than yours, hospital, right? Like,
right. Like,
that data speaks to the fact that our presence is a present, and that's something that also we need to be proud of and be trying to, like, to rally around. Because I think the doulas do a great job of rallying around the ways that hospitals fail, but sometimes we also don't do a good job of rallying about how much we show up.
Yeah. And to that point, something I would like to see in terms of support for doulas is just around the compensation piece. I know that with...
Well, how much time we got left? Because that is another...
Go ahead and speak on it. Go ahead and speak on it. And then we'll give you an opportunity to make a final word. But I think this needs to get lifted up, because doula work, like you said, your presence is a present. It does support birth outcomes and also how people feel satisfied around their birthing experiences. And, you know, doulas are not necessarily captured in terms of, like, what is billable for medical insurance. And then the people who could use doulas the most don't necessarily have the out-of-pocket money to be paying for, you know, what the market level rate is for a doula. So give me your piece on the payment piece.
Listen, the payment piece is they be violating, son. They be violating. Like,
who's they? Who's,
like,
they? Who's
city violating? Projects that be trying to be like, oh, we're gonna have doula support. And then you get played all the way around. So one of the things that we also have in common, the founders of, BX Rebirth, is also that we have all worked, you know, have all collaborated with city-led initiatives to be able to diversify doula access. And one of the things that happened was that they weren't paying. I mean, I'm talking about, like, on some old, it's an entire fiscal year. I done went to the baby's first birthday party and the city has not paid me for the birth.
Wow.
Right. And then B is the fact that when they pay, the payment is so low that it's almost insulting. Right. If you're with somebody, it's not uncommon. I've been at births where I've been there for 28 hours at a time. Like, I'm talking about, like, on some, it's an induction. My client is scared. They need support. Who, like, $28, and then the compensation might be something like $600, literally every hour.
Okay, let me do the math on that. I want to do the math on this. So $600 divided by 28 hours is about $21 per hour. Meanwhile, you got to make sure you get some food while you're there.
If you got kids,
it's physically laborious. Yes,
it's physically laborious. Because it's not like you out here for the most part. You out here dozing, even if you catch a nap, which a lot of doulas just don't, you sitting up in a chair in somebody's cold ass hospital right? And you're very aware of the way that your client is. I'm doing this work. I don't sleep, right? I got to eat.
And I also want to point out, too, that your work doesn't start when the labor starts. Correct. And doesn't end when the baby is Correct. Delivered. So we divided it by 28-hour labor, but we're not talking about the prenatal period where you're having conversations about a birth plan and right. making choices around, like, you know, what's going on. We're not talking about the postpartum piece where you're supporting people with their transition into parenthood yep. or their transition with this child into parenting this child. Like, there are so many other hours exactly. that also need to be compensated. And before you even a doula, you're putting in hours in terms of like learning, studying, reading up, et cetera. Making sure, yeah, right. So it actually isn't even $20 an hour. Kit, it might actually be below minimum absolutely. Wage.
And your kit is like, you know, you have to have, you come in with stuff, right? I'm coming with like tennis balls and a Rebozo. And, you know, if you have
supplies
if you yeah. have small children, you might have to compensate somebody else for childcare, right? If you Ooh. Are driving, you have to maybe pay for a garage. So when you're looking at,
to put your car
in, yeah. right, so that you can park, because you can't park somewhere that's going to have you coming out every 2-3 hours to put money in the meter.
Right, feeding the meter.
And if you are feeding the meter, you're feeding the meter, right? If you don't live close to the client, you might need to take an Uber because they might call you at 2:00 in the morning and the MTA ain't reliable at that time. So it ain't reliable no time.
When, but first of all, when it is it reliable?
No time. But at that time, it certainly is not reliable either. So these are all right. situations that are happening at the same time. And so the numbers that they are throwing at us just do not reflect. As a matter of fact, they had another thing where they were trying to do like a Medicaid initiative last year. And that was a big thing because they started in 2 counties, which is Erie in, you know, upstate New York, I think, and Kings in Brooklyn. And I want to say that they were trying to compensate people for like, something like $500 per birth. Who, Sway? Like how, Sway? How?
And also, just so people have some perspective, because, you know, to some folks, $500 might feel like a lot of money, but then also consider that the market level rate, meaning what a doula could potentially charge, can be at least $1,500, a couple thousand dollars, depending on their level of expertise, their experience, the other right. things that they right. bring to their doula stuff. Maybe they, you know some other, they're certified in other things like lactation counseling, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things require money to attend the courses, right. to be certified if it's a certifying thing.
And, like,
and then on top of that, you're not a single person. You are a parent yourself.
Right. And you're talking about New York, right? So it's like that's another piece that is like the market rate and that the majority of people that they would have included in this project are Black women. So again, like all of these, a lot of the doulas for like the city-led right. initiatives are Black women who also need, right? We need to live. In fact, one person did the math, I think, and it was something like, you would have to do something like 30 births to be able to clear like 30,000 or something like that. And it's like, what? Who? First of all, 30 births is not just time consuming, but it's also meat. And it was, I think, 50 births.
Over the course of 12 right. months?
50 births in order to be able to clear something like 12,000. And 50 births means that you are also, none of your time is your own, right?
Yeah, that's at least 4 births.
That's at least 4 births a month, which means that you are constantly on call. You have no time to make any type, like just to make $50,000. So the amount that we have been compensated, but then we found out that it wasn't that much lower than what they compensate midwives for. And so, which is why I say wow. that everybody's battle is collective, right? Because we also want midwives to make more money. Right. When they cover births that are covered by Medicaid, like so that those are real options for them. So it's like really thinking about the fact that so it's not like, oh, doulas are over there and midwives, for example, are over here. We have different roles in the process, but we work collaboratively together. And when one person rises, like everybody rises. Right.
Yeah.
The prioritization of the efforts and the work that Black women give has to be lifted. Because it's often yeah. like, oh, well, you know, you can just do open market births. And that's true, too. But like then we leave a whole.
What does that mean? Open market
like, you know, births. Like births that they can pay whatever your full rate is. Right. But then we're also.
Oh, as a way to right. offset the ones exactly. where you charge less.
So and lots of. Doulas,
but that's still more work to get.
Exactly. And that we also yeah. run the risk of leaving people that are most marginalized, most vulnerable, that actually really need the relationships that are created by having by having a doula, we leave them on the wayside. So then we don't throw people away. And if we don't throw people away, then how can we make sure that the people that are supporting people that need, that have different needs, that they also get, that they also get what they need, right? Like I was, you know, and that was one of the things that Carmen and I first connected on, because we were doing that, this particular initiative at the same time. And it was like, Carmen was constantly arguing with the Department of Health, like, why are y'all like this? Why are y'all not creating systems?
Oh yeah, I was in a couple meetings where she went off about that. She was just like, y'all need to pay people and you need to pay them now, because people have been waiting for at least 12 months to get their money, and this is unacceptable. It is
absolutely unacceptable. And so, and then 12 months, and by the time that you figure that, you're like, what? All of that work. And the thing is that, like, you know, to your point, Taja, is the idea that we're looking at, I'm talking about 28 hours at the birth. We're not talking about the six time, you know, like the overarching text messages back and forth that I'm having when they send me pictures of their mucus plug, when they calling me at 2 o'clock in the morning and talk about some, I just had sex. Do you think that I did the right thing? Should I, how many cups of this tea should I be drinking? I just walked around the mall, depending on the needs that the clients have, because their lifestyle also, sometimes people are like, oh, I don't, my mom doesn't think I should breastfeed. Let's talk about it. You know? So again, you're utilizing a whole host of acquired skills to make people feel like, you know, to remind them that they have what it takes to be able to go through this process. And so to feel like those efforts are devalued is such a hurtful thing. You know, it is such a hurtful thing. And so when we talk about like that advocacy that, you know, Nicole has really been instrumental in doing through BX Rebirth and Progress, I mean, really all of us, but like, that's, you know, that, like, that's her sweet spot, I think, that those are the things that we're talking about. Like, just compensate us, because when you lift Black women, you lift everybody else. Period. Okay. Like, that's just like, right. And that's it. When you lift Black women, you lift everybody, because so much of the work of humanity falls on our back. So it behooves everybody to look out for us, because when you look out for us, we look out for everybody. And then, you know, just a reminder that like all health is maternal health, that there is no space that does not impact directly maternal health. When we talk about economic justice, that's maternal health. If we're talking about restorative justice, that's maternal health. If you're talking about reproductive, you know, justice, that's maternal health. So all health is maternal health. And we really need to be able to recognize, because sometimes also we've been talking a lot at, you know, BX Rebirth in the way that maternal health has been so siloed and marginalized.
Yeah.
And that also, and because of
this thing that happens over there, but it's like integrated with everything else. It is not separate from all the other stuff that's happening.
Right. And so really being able to see that and to lift that at every opportunity, that when you lift anything else, you're lifting up maternal health. You cannot silo it as a way of like, oh, because that's, you know, cause then we start talking about patriarchy and paternalism and all those other things, but that's what it is, that there's been a real comfort historically, and particularly of like the experiences of Black people, Black birthing people, have been kind of like, oh, they're going to be all right. They're going to be all right. And it's like, no, we're here to be like, no, we need to be centered, and we will center ourselves as much as we possibly can.
And I want to just underscore something that you were bringing up earlier in case some folks didn't catch it, which is that a lot of the people who are serving the folks who are most vulnerable or susceptible to this maternal mortality stuff, right? Like they are part of that population too. They look like that population too. They share income brackets. They share racial status. Like all of that is intertwined. So when we're talking about creating programs to support particular communities and wanting to make sure that the doulas who are hired in those programs look like the folks that they're going to serve, that it is all integrated. And so the way, and many of y'all are, you know, like many doulas are also parents, many doulas, like there's so many shared experiences. And when we talk about pay equity, you know, in terms of like what Black women make versus white women, not that white women are the standard, but to sort of show what the disparity is, because white women also ain't making what white men are making, you know, all of that. It just gets at this, like, there's like structures on structures. Like we've been looking at hospital systems, but we also have to look at things like the health department, as you mentioned, other city programs that are saying we want to support people in this way. Well, then what does it mean to support? Because you supporting those folks means also supporting the folks that you hire, because they are also part of that same population too. And so how we show up there is, to the point you made earlier, how we show up there is how we show up.
Yeah, and it's so very important. And so, like I am in the community that I serve. right? It's not as if
you are of the community that you serve.
I have neighbors that I have clients that live 800 feet from me.
Mm.
Like, so we out here sharing coupons to go to Western Beef, right? Like, right? Yes. Like, yes. I'm like, look, bitch, I got an extra, I got four potatoes. What you got, right? Like, right? When we chopping, you know?
Yes.
When we, you know, like, I often, as part of my postpartum support, like, we gonna cook. Because when you go home from the hospital, I want you to have a couple things for the crock pot, you know, that you can just throw in. We're trying to make some, you know, like some veggie lasagna or something that we can put in the freezer. So all you got to do is take it out and put it in the oven. And I have to stand over the stove, you know, 2 days postpartum. And so I've had clients that'll be like, I ain't got no carrots. I got you.
Let me bring some
carrots. Let me bring my little jar of cumin. So we could really season this bad boy up so that you could have some, you know what I mean? So it's like, so we are sharing resources on every level. And so it's that much more important for people to recognize that, like, help us so that we can help, right? Be prioritize our needs so that we can be out there supporting people and doing this work. And we cannot continue to do it because it is not sustainable without being sustained.
Exactly. Exactly. Your ability to show up means that your needs need to be taken care of. And you listed all of those needs earlier, everything from parking a car, taking an Uber, childcare, eating, like you need to be able to pay your rent. Like all of those things need to be taken care of in order for you to be able to show up for other folks. All right, so we're going to wrap up, but before we close, we talked about a lot, but I'm curious if there's anything else you wanted to share that maybe didn't get captured in my questions or in our conversation.
Just a way to really kind of keep up with us. So Bronx Rebirth, you know, it's for people who may be interested in what it is that we're doing. We are at BX Rebirth on Instagram, and also Bronx Rebirth, B-R-O-N-X Rebirth at gmail.com if you want to send us an email. So if you know someone who is Bronx-based, we're actually keeping it very local right now in terms of our donations. But send us an email in the event, and we'll send you the Google form so that you can ask, so that you can make requests. So I know lots of people.
And I'll put that in the show notes too, so folks can easily access that.
Wonderful. Otherwise, let's see, my own personal handle is Ripeness at, on Instagram, and it's R-I-P-E-N-E-S-S. Just beware, I like jokes and fuckery. So if you like jokes and fuckery, then, you know, I am your person. and if you want to talk about anything doula related, definitely check in with BX Rebirth in Progress.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Evelyn, for this lovely, insightful, lively conversation.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Really grateful to have been included as a guest. And shout out to everybody else that's on this first season. Yo, I feel like a heavy hitter right now. Like, you got me gagged.
Yeah, you a heavy hitter, girl. Right. You heavy hitter.
I wish I could see me Millie rocking right now. I'm like, ah. 30, son. 30, 30. Woo.
Yes. All right, we're complete. See, now I told y'all Evelyn was a dynamic time traveling doula. I loved our conversation on time. From how medical institutions use time in oppressive ways, and how doulas stop time for their clients, so that pregnant and laboring people can know what is going on and take a more active role in their healthcare. Evelyn left us with a lot of nuggets, including the importance and value of centering Black women and Black birthing people, and the importance of committing resources to our values. Like Evelyn said, all health is maternal health. There is no space that does not directly impact maternal health. So if you got anything from this episode and from the first season of this podcast, I hope it is this, that many systems impact our health. This includes, but is certainly not limited to, healthcare systems. I hope this episode and this season has left y'all feeling both informed and inspired. Shifting inequitable health outcomes is going to require the transformation, convergence, and collaboration of multiple stakeholders and systems. We'll dive deeper into this in season 2 and beyond. Thank you for rocking with us on this journey. Please continue to share and support the podcast. While we're not releasing episodes, we'll still be hard at work behind the scenes, crafting your future listening experience. Be sure to fill out the listener survey. The link is in the show notes. And follow us on Instagram at BirthJusticeNYC. Big shout out to Emma Alabaster for editing each and every episode for your listening pleasure and for crafting the opening music and soundscape you hear at the top of every episode. As a reminder, this podcast is produced by Color Girls Hustle and is made possible in part by the Narrative Power Stipend, a grant by Forward Together from members of Echoing Ida. All right, y'all, I'm gonna see y'all on the internet and in season two. Until then, take good care and be well.